Hi, I'm Brian McCreath, and this is The Answered Question from WCRB in Boston for May 5th, 2017. You're hearing part of the Sixth Symphony by Dmitri Shostakovich from last week's Boston Symphony Concert at Symphony Hall. And this part is the beginning of what Andras Nelsons described on last week's podcast as a sort of manic episode that ends the piece. You can hear the entire Shostakovich Sixth Symphony on demand at our website, classicalwcrb.org. Also on the concert is Shostakovich's festive overture and Tchaikovsky's violin concerto with Anne-Sophie Mutter, both of which are also available on demand. Unfortunately, due to publisher restrictions, Takemitsu's Nostalgia is not available on demand, but you can hear it on our encore broadcast of the entire concert on Monday night, May 8th at 8 p.m. On the podcast this week, you'll hear from both pianist Leif Ove Andsnes and conductor Andras Nelsons about this week's Boston Symphony program, which will broadcast live on Saturday at 8 p.m. Also, Kathy Fuller talks with three members of the Boston Chamber Music Society, which plays a couple of fantastic British pieces on WCRB in concert on Sunday at 7 p.m. Leif Ove Andsnes is the soloist in Rachmaninoff's Piano Concerto No. 4 with the BSO. It's not a piece that comes up too often, especially in comparison to the composer's second and third piano concertos. In fact, it relates to those earlier pieces in the same way that maybe Shostakovich's Sixth Symphony relates to the other symphonies by Shostakovich. It's more compact and concentrated, but it still has the markers of the composer's language. So when I met Leif Ove Andsnes earlier this week at Symphony Hall, with, as you'll hear, soprano Christina Opelais warming up in the next room, I asked him about how he thinks of the piece and whether he approaches it in the same way as Rachmaninoff's other concertos.
It is a much more restless concerto, isn't it? It goes from one character to another very quickly, and that is very important to immediately get that character. Especially the first movement is full of transitions. Very difficult, not only for the pianist, but for the conductor and for the orchestra also. It's a challenging concerto. Maybe that's one of the reasons why it's not so often played. And it still has those wonderful melodies, but they are not that long, and it doesn't have the long breath of, especially like the third concerto. But it has these wonderful, rich harmonies of late Rachmaninoff, which are sometimes slightly jazzy. You know, you think of the beginning of the second movement sounds like Bill Evans, you know, and sometimes a little bit something mystique like Scriabin harmonies, and other times I think it's almost like he's influenced already by American music, though the concerto was written in Russia, but it was rewritten and several times. So also when he came to the States, he made the last version quite late. And so the ending of the first movement, I think, sounds a little urban, like Copland or Stravinsky from his American period. So it's a mixture of things. And the last movement is very rhythmic. One can think of Prokofiev, you know, it's not that melodic anymore. It's, you know, what we identify with Rachmaninoff. So he's very influenced by the music which was around him at the time, you know. It's a very exciting concerto. I love it. But it takes time for the audience to grasp it. And also because people don't know it. They are sometimes surprised when they first hear it.
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned Scriabin, because I think if some people sort of go in, maybe with that association, maybe some things make a little bit more sense. All those transitions you're talking about, all sort of these sudden left turns, or however you want to describe it, like, whoa, what was that? That's not what we're used to with Rachmaninoff. And it, you know, he didn't write another concerto after this one. And so it makes me wonder, I don't know if you've ever wondered, like, what would he have done next if he had continued, you know, with another one based on what he did on the fourth?
Yeah, well, he did write the Paganini Rhapsody, yeah. Which is a marvelous piece, of course, but very different because it's a variation piece. But I think that this already has the sort of trademarks of late Rachmaninoff, and especially in the harmonies. they are killing me. They're so painful and so beautiful and so deep, but they don't last very long. Because it's a restless concerto, and I sometimes think that maybe he was, also. There's this late romantic aesthetic sometimes, but there is also a lot of the optimism of the beginning of the century and the joy of speed, of machinery and railways. And I sometimes, think of these passages in Rachmaninoff as like a train going by. there's a great mixture of things in this piece. I'm trying to champion it now. I play it quite a lot at the moment because I find it's just a shame that people don't know that this great Rachmaninoff concerto exists.
Well, I love that imagery along with the association with Scriabin. I love the imagery you're talking about with the early 20th century. That's great. I read an interview that you did when you were deep into Sibelius and you made a recording of Sibelius's solo music, I think, right? And you said something like, with Sibelius, because he wasn't a pianist, you sort of have to look for what it is that he was. I couldn't remember exactly how you put it, but you have to search for his voice in the music,
mm-hmm.
And which is a really interesting idea to begin with Rachmaninoff, because he was such a great pianist. Is it sort of the opposite? Do you sort of look at the part and you know exactly what he was trying to do?
Well, as I get to a stage where I sort of can master playing my part, then I discover, how incredibly it's written in terms of colors for the piano, but it's technically demanding, and how creative he was in his piano writing. I wonder how he was, sitting down and improvising. He was probably just quite incredible, because he has a way with figurations at the piano and with harmonies, and it just all goes together, which is quite something. So it's when you play Rachmaninoff's music, you cannot have too small hands, because he had very big hands. So that is a disadvantage for some pianists. I've my hands are not too bad, so I can get around it. And if one can, it just is a wonderful feeling to play this music. It's such a sensual feeling for the hands. It just fits. Like the greatest piano composers, like Chopin, like Debussy. It's a sensual feeling to play it.
The big project that took up a lot of your most recent years was the Beethoven Journey, and that involved quite a bit more than playing all five concertos in a season. I mean, that's something sometimes people do, or even in 2 weeks or something like that. That's a big achievement to begin with, but you took it to a further step as touring and recording and as the conductor for the project. And I wondered, when you were doing it, could you pull that off with any other composer, or that deep involvement, is that reserved for someone like Beethoven?
I learned a lot by doing this project. I basically worked only on Beethoven's music for 3 years, and not only the concertos, but like 10 sonatas, chamber music, and it did a lot to me. For instance, Beethoven's music is the most, I think, sincere music there is. There is no theater, there is nothing to hide behind. You need to make every statement so clear, because every note, every phrase is so important. There's a goal to everything. He has something important to say. And this incredible honesty in the music that I think, after a while I've felt like I'm becoming a different musician, and that does something to you. But anyway, I think one can do projects like this with some other composers. Certainly Mozart, Schubert, Schumann. There are composers who have a lot of great piano music. But of course, the diversity of the music of Beethoven is quite special, and the fact that he wrote piano music from very early on, the piano was his instrument, till the very late sonatas, they are extremely different pieces.
One of the things that I really liked looking at from afar as you did it was your several years at the Risor Festival. And now, having left your leadership there for a couple of years, I guess, now you've you've just started another festival. Mm. And I'm just curious. I mean, that's such a artistically rich project, I'm sure, for anyone to take on. But what is it that lured you back in to do another small festival like this?
Well,
I should say, by the way, it's the Rosendal Festival that we're talking about, just to give it a name.
Yes, and the place Rosendal is a small town in western part of Norway where there is a manor house with a big, wonderful English garden around, wonderful mountains, and it's by the fjord. It's quite a unique setting. And a couple of years ago, they decided to build a chamber hall, 550 seats in the farm, which is connected to the manor house. It's the old barn, and I was involved in that process. I've been playing small concerts in the manor house for years, but now with this new hall, we could actually think of doing something bigger. And I got very excited about it. So now we have a concentrated festival from a Thursday to Sunday in August with 8 programs or so, and I want to do it on the highest level. And last summer we had a theme called 1828, which is the year that Schubert died and when he wrote some of his greatest pieces. So there was a lot of Schubert. And this summer there will be a lot of Mozart, and I'm really, really enjoying it. I, as you mentioned, I was doing the Riso Festival from very early on when I was 22, and I was doing it for 17 years, and it became such a big part of my life. And I think I have the curator has been become a big part of, well, at least a part of me as a musician, that I love to curate programs and I love to bring people together to play together and to create a hall like a festival, not only to jump around and play a program here and there. I really enjoy doing it again, I have to say.
And one final question. You just finished up, I mean, just days ago, you finished up this tour. I think you finished it. I don't know if there's more coming, but with Marc-André Hamelin,
yes,
who's one of our favorite musicians here in Boston. We know him well.
I know.
And there's no question of what a magnificent musician he is. So this question isn't really like why him, but in general, when you're looking at collaborations with artists, what is it you're looking for? How do you sort of like figure out who you'd like to work with, especially on something as deep as that was with Mark, where you did the Rite of Spring and lots of other two piano pieces?
Well, with Mark, I invited him to the Riso Chamber Music Festival in 2008, and he was there both in 2008 and in 2010, which was the last year I was doing it. And I, of course, knew quite a few of his recordings, his magnificent recordings. And then he suggested to me, why don't we do Rite of Spring on two pianos? That was, and I was quite skeptical because I thought of it as, this is the iconic orchestra piece. How can you do it on pianos? But it has been, one of the great joys the last decade for me to do this piece with him on stage. We have done it about 20 times. And now, just a month ago, we made a Stravinsky recording, which is coming out next year with the Rite of Spring and with his concerto for two pianos and other pieces. And we have done now a tour of 13 concerts, and it's a wonderful partnership. I just really, really enjoy it, and I would like to continue in the future. He's a great, great pianist and musician with such an integrity and clear mind about the music.
Well, I can't wait to see what the next chapter is for you guys. I mean, the more you can partner, the better, as far as I'm concerned, because I love both your playing and it's great stuff. I can't wait to hear the recording. Thanks so much for taking some time to talk with me today.
Thanks a lot.
Leifova Ansnes is the guest soloist in Rachmaninoff's Piano Concerto No. 4 in this week's Boston Symphony Concerts, including Saturday night's live broadcast on WCRB. Actually, he's one of two guest soloists. The other is soprano Christina Opelais, whom you heard warming up in the background of that interview. She's singing in Mahler's 4th Symphony, in which the final movement is a song that expresses a child's view of what heaven must be like. Later on, you'll hear more about the program from Andres Nelsons, the BSO's music director. On Sunday at 7, Kathy Fuller brings you a performance by the Boston Chamber Music Society that includes music by British composers Arnold Bax and Arthur Bliss. When she got together with three members of the group, they talked about some of the particular challenges of each of their instruments and these really fascinating British pieces they played. Here's their conversation.
I have got three of the members of the Boston Chamber Music Society with me, Artistic director Marcus Thompson, violist, has been with the Boston Chamber Music Society since the beginning, since 1982, has been the artistic director since 2009. Dmitri Murat, probably one of the newer members of the Boston Chamber Music Society, violist, and Peggy Pearson, oboist. It's great to have you here. There's this quote by Arthur Bliss, which I think is great. He said, "I don't claim to have done more than light a small taper at the shrine of music." It's not very good, like, self-marketing. And in a way, sometimes I think for some composers, they kind of do themselves in a way that way. But Peggy Pearson, one of the great oboists of the world, this is one of your pieces, right? The Bliss Quintet. Is this all oboists play this piece?
Actually, this is the first time I've ever played this piece.
Wow. And what do you think of it?
I'm really enjoying it. I love it.
Does he understand your instrument?
Yeah, he writes beautifully for the oboe. He's got there's a little bit of everything about the oboe in this piece. It's pastoral. It's impressionistic. It's very romantic. And it's also spiky. It's a little bit jazzy. It has a little bit of astringent quality to it.
So you get to kind of do it all.
Yep. It's excellent.
What do you think people mostly don't know about the oboe? Is there some sort of stuff that people aren't thinking when they think about the oboe?
I think the oboe has been typecast a little bit as an instrument that plays beautiful, soulful melodies.
And you're more than soul.
Sort of like the duck in Peter and the Wolf.
Well, yeah, that's a thing.
But since Holliger has been playing the oboe, it's really taken on a new role, and it's much more, there's much more virtuosic music written for the oboe.
Heinz Holliger, who's also a composer.
Yes.
And so new music for the oboe, I know as part of the Windsor Music, you have really made sure that new music is being written for the oboe. But when you play a piece like this with strings, is it just easy to balance because the strings are so different, or do you sometimes have to be careful about being too prominent?
Well, I love playing with strings. It's my favorite thing to do.
Is it?
And I think it's because the oboe can blend with the strings, but it also can separate itself from the strings and pop out in different ways.
I think some people may not know. I remember when years in ancient times ago when I was at New England Conservatory and I would move from apartment to apartment, you could always tell when an oboe had been living there because there were all those beautiful colored pieces of string around all the furniture. I mean, what is involved? Do all oboists, people may not realize the trouble you have to go through to make your reeds.
I think most oboe players spend more time making reeds than they spend practicing.
I knew one oboist who had a collection of reeds, and they were all named after different television programs.
Yes, that's
it was like
true.
A Friends reed, you know, and a Frasier
like
reed.
Rockford Files reed, yeah.
But it's hard, so they can fail on you, right?
They do fail, and they're very temperamental. They change with the humidity. And so with the weather, they change. If you go into an air-conditioned room, they change.
So you got to have something at the ready pretty much all the time in case of something.
And a backup.
Okay. So this Bliss, while it does have some serenity, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
And to achieve that.
Very pastoral.
Yeah. And I guess the oboe sort of has that sound.
Definitely, yeah.
But that's got to be hard. I mean, these long, long lines. What do you do to prep yourself for serene lines?
Well, long lines, that's what the oboe is good for. We can play for as long as we can hold our breath, basically. So in a lot of the time when we take a breath, it's to get rid of bad air. Rather than, because it's not necessarily because we need air for our lungs. It's just because we need to get rid of the old air.
What's bad air?
Air that is just, if you hold your breath for a half a minute, you have to release the air that's in there before you can take another breath.
I see.
So a lot of the time when I come to a spot where you would think I would take a breath, I actually exhale instead of taking a breath. And what comes in is enough to keep the phrase going for quite a long time.
When you're playing chamber music and you're in front of a crowd, do you have to think about how you look as an oboist at all? Is that something
I think
you have
I
to
would
worry
kill
about?
Myself if
if
I
you had
about
to do that. Is there a favorite spot in the Bliss? Is there a really goosebump moment?
There are a few very beautiful harmonies.
Yeah. In which movement? I mean, is there a moment that you can spot for me, like slow movement or?
Toward the end of the slow movement, there's some very beautiful music.
This is a very specific time period that we're talking about, Marcus Thompson. How did you put this together?
Well, these are all pieces that were written between battles, the great battles we think of as World War I and World War II. And they were certainly at a time when the British were not, as a group of composers, really all that plugged into what was going on in Europe. If anything, they wanted to keep their Emerald Isle separate from what was going on elsewhere. And even though it shows some kind of French influence, it's purely, really purely English. You can really hear the difference. I think it started with Dmitri telling me he wanted to play the Bach's Sonata. And so if that's on a program, what do you put before it? What do you put after it? I think there's also the other origin. I think a year and a half ago, I played the Bliss in another series. And this was for me coming back to it after having not played it for about 20 years. And, you know, my first encounter with this was with Han de Vries in Holland. And we went on a tour. And as usual, there wasn't enough rehearsal time. We just sort of, I said, well, okay, sit down, let's play this. This is a really hard piece. And I sat down and I'm all concentrated, ready to play it. And I realized, oh my God, this is beautiful. Oh, can't we just stop and do that again? Oh, I just want to hear it, you know. It was that kind of reaction. And every night, you know, I just, you know, my eyes are just open to the beauty of this piece.
Dmitri, what is most misunderstood about the viola?
I'm thinking.
Viola jokes popping up.
That's right.
Left and right.
No, I think it's a tricky instrument. I think probably what's most misunderstood is to compare it to the violin. I think it's not that close to the violin as we assume. It's much more something right in between the violin and the cello. And I think it sounds like a very close to a human voice. There is that range. I mean, it's very hard to hear a human voice go as high as a violin or as low as a cello, but it's just that kind of medium range.
What is it about this sonata for viola and piano, written in 1922 by Arnold Bax, that you so love?
I love the fantasy. It doesn't really sound like English music or French music or German music. It has an identity of its own. It's a lot of fantasy. Yeah. It reminds me of that Disney movie, Fantasia. Yeah. Maybe there is at some point the scene with the apprentice sorcier.
Sorcerer's apprentice.
Sorcerer's apprentice, and you know, some sort of fantastical things that you lose control of. There's a lot of that, particularly in the second movement, I would say. Yeah.
Like a crazy spell cast upon you guys.
Yes, absolutely.
I think there is a general feeling about the viola that it's just really hard, right?
Well, not anymore.
Everybody can do everything.
Well, yeah. You know, people play so well these days that you don't get the feeling that people play the viola because they couldn't play anything else, or that only composers play viola, you know, the composer of the viola. No. I think people play it because they love it and because it fits their idea of sound. And you know, there's a mastery of it in our community especially, and I think throughout the country, that's just undeniable. And so I think it's come into its own.
Well, I could tell you, when I do sit down to play the piano, which is much less than it should be, but when I'm doing something that has an inner part, I actually think of, sometimes it's Mai Motobuchi playing with the Borromeo Quartet, the way she leans in and brings out the turmoil of that inner voice, even in a Mozart, for me, that's like an incredible inspiration, because it's the stuff, it's the plot, it's the stuff that's going on in the middle, it's stuff that enlivens everything. And that's only in classical literature, of course, but I think the viola needs to be heard much, much, much more.
Oh, I'm so glad you said that, because the kind of chamber music that wants the middle parts to be passive in relation to the outer parts is just not of any interest to me. As a matter of fact, I have a little story to tell. I had a friend of mine, a composer, once asked, well, what do you think of that piece, just in general? And I said, oh, it's a really great piece. And then he asked a more telling question. He says, well, do you enjoy your part? And I suddenly realized, oh, okay, so one can be a part of many great pieces and not enjoy your part in it, but enjoy the experience. But in chamber music and in these pieces, our parts, our inner parts, and even in Peggy's piece, where her part is sometimes leading and sometimes an inner part, these are cherishable parts. They are so beautiful. And, that's why we do this. We do this because of the beauty that's inside that really contributes to the beauty of the whole.
Well, thank you for that. I think, running a chamber music series is an incredible thing to do. And I hope that people get there, because it's really life-changing if you let yourself in, and you guys open your arms and let this audience in. So thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You can hear the Boston Chamber Music Society on WCRB in concert this Sunday at 7 p.m. And check back afterwards to hear their performance on demand. And now back to the BSO, which begins Saturday's program with a suite from Shostakovich's incidental music for Shakespeare's King Lear. Andras Nelsons and I talked about that piece in a continuation of our conversation about the composer's Sixth Symphony, which was on last week's concert. So we'll pick it up right there.
About King Lear, then, the King Lear suite, written for a stage production, but the themes, power, vanity, these things are in King Lear. Was Shostakovich writing music in the same way that there was a sort of message to it, or was he just writing music for the play?
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting, difficult to say as well, because as we know, he was a genius composer and he wrote absolutely great for any occasion. He could write a music for ballet, for cartoons, for communist party conference, for any, and also symphony. And of course, therefore, all music for theater very, very, of course, easily. And of course, and such a master as Shakespeare, of course, I'm sure it's very tempting and interesting for composer to. I somehow think that even in King Lear, and there, of course, are these human good and bad things and the power. And I think he always, in a way, somehow reflects his position towards such a things as, dictatorship, or, I mean, dictatorship is one thing, but he reflects what he experiences in his life, I think, and even this is through Shakespeare, but I think, because the music, they're nice fanfares, but they're all very Shostakovich, you feel it's dumb. They're kind of fun, but there is a link to the 20th century as well. It's somehow.
And as you describe that, your fingers are moving in a way that is familiar to me, because I play the trumpet. And so I know that you don't only think about the trumpets, but that his use of trumpets and fanfares especially is something that you're very in touch with, because you've played it and you've conducted it, and so. The difference between a fanfare in another composer and a fanfare in Shostakovich is really significant.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the fanfare in Shostakovich music is very significant, absolutely, because it doesn't have only the messaging function. It is announcing it's a brave fanfare, because it's announcing the something disastrous, but in such a circusy way. Mm-hmm. So it's very it's a big challenge, not a challenge, it's a big courage you know, to write it that way, and then to provoke and to say, or the piano concerto. It's not just, it is actually, it's you know, it's very strong. It's very, whatever.
There's a real intensity to those fanfares that he writes, right? There's actually some kind of drive and emotion that you don't find in a normal fanfare when Shostakovich writes them.
And also, also in King Lear, they are very interesting and dramatic. And in the meantime, he can write a very simple melody and very easily, very small orchestrated things. But there is, you feel the King Lear's, you know, of course, the story of the Shakespeare, but it's, you also hear the parallel, what he feels, what happening in that time, because this is written also around that time when this is sixth and seventh symphony, so he cannot ignore what happens around. I think that's he's so genius and clever that he knows how to write, to, you know, that he manages to not be accused again. But so therefore, I think I'm sorry, it's just very, I honestly feel, you know, now talking about Shostakovich is more scary because you think what happens around, and obviously the disastrous wars or killing people, that's whether it's ISIS or it's just disaster. But now I watched this news, there was a air company flying, and there were simply too many people. They were booked, and then they threw out people just like that, you know, just
drag them off the plane.
But how, you know, so where is the human values, and where is even the rules? So it's, everything starts to shake, even where we really think we should be able to sustain the humanity and to give example. You know, if we are fighting for good things, we have to give example at least. You know, so anyway, this brings to, you know, to think deeper and deeper about also music, and of course, therefore performing Shostakovich is very actual. But I think it's also, as any time, that this time, I think it's, well, I think people really need music and need art and need to have this feeling of unity. And I think the music gives this so much. It gives a satisfaction. It gives a comfort. It comforts you. It sometimes can be dramatic, and of course it gives you worries, but then it somehow unites people. I think that's also the great thing, because if you come into the concert hall, I mean, the Boston Symphony Hall is one of the best concert halls, of course. There are more than 2,000 people, and that unity, when you listen to the music together and applaud, it brings also the people together, and I think they feel it, and they go home and they feel more they have more necessity to be nice to each other, because music is still it's human, it's about, of course, good and bad, and about life, but it has values which are, you know, very human, and that's the, you know, therefore I'm encouraging everyone to just to enjoy the great music this wonderful orchestra plays, and we have such amazing soloists, and I think really we are sharing this great music, and I really think it's a food for our soul, and particularly in these times it can really, it does comfort me. I certainly, and I just want to wish that everyone could experience this feeling.
And I love that you're ending the season with Mahler 4 and with your wife. It's great that she's here. And she'll sing beautifully, of course. I don't know how much she's sung this before. I mean, her voice is so made for Mahler 4. But this is music that, especially after living with a little bit of Shostakovich, mm-hmm. and to end up at Mahler, and particularly this Mahler symphony, that is pure beauty, you know, feels like a great way to end the season.
Yes, of course, I'm very happy we have the last program is we have Christina singing in Mahler, and then Live of Anders playing Rachmaninoff, fourth piano concerto, and of course we have Mahler 4, and King Lear, of course. So I think it's quite, as you said, from one side, it's very beautiful. It's the slow movement of the third movement of Mahler's 4. It's so beautiful, you know. It's sad, but it's so beautiful. It's, and then going to the last moment, which is with the singer, is like an angel singing. It's in a paradise. And it's so simple, beautiful, and you think that Mahler got it, the feeling of what a life is about, but obviously.
Well, I mean, it's nice that on that program you begin with King Lear, which is mm-hmm. dealing with these motivations mm-hmm. and feelings of people that are difficult mm-hmm. and not great, you know, not helpful. Mm-hmm. and then by the end of that program, you're reminded of what the important things are, you know, being with people and having food and, yeah. you know, being in a place that's peaceful.
Yes, no, that's true. And of course, again, the Rachmaninoff fourth concerto is also quite dramatic. He was very afraid of death, obviously, and it's quite dark. It's quite different from third. It's more scary, you know, and it's...
Yes.
And then, of course, comes... Maybe it, in a way, as a reminder about the life can be beautiful. It can be also so great, you know. It's saying, please, we still love and we still suffer, of course, suffer for love. And you feel that, I always feel in Mahler, I mean, I it's maybe my problem, but I always feel with Mahler that he loved Alma so much. He really, really, I mean, he was not obviously a very easy person, and but from the moment he met Alma, also in his letters and in his writing, how he writes, and compared to how he writes his letters to other people, he really loved her. I mean, and I'm sure she did too, but not as much as he did her. Because, and I think you can hear it in music, and therefore there is this, from one hand, there is a beauty, but there is also sometimes something so sad and so something, you know, he knows it's not going to fulfill. And this is very sad, but it's also beautiful because it is love, but it's, you know, it is... but these are very nice and human things. It's a very, you know, comparing to the bombing or, you know...
Yes, they're within each of us. There's an intimacy. Compared to the more large dynamic of Shostakovich, which is a sort of us against the world or some such thing, right?
But of course, but even in Mahler, of course, there's always a... The dark part in our world, but the beauty of and the naiveness of the last moment of the fourth symphony, and then it gets softer and softer and softer, and it's just so beautiful. And yeah, and I think that gives a parallel to what happens and to the world. And I think, I really hope, and I think we as musicians and artists, we should, you know, should very, what only we can do, we very actively do our thing, which is make music and invite people and talk through the music and to emphasize how important it is and to comfort people with music.
That's
what we can do. And
that's what
and of course it's also the end of this. It's our end of the, of our symphonic season. Then it's Boston Pop start, and then is again Tanglewood, and so the life continues, of course. And then Mahler also writes ta da da dam after that. So there is life is also a circle, constant circle.
Well, and you started talking as we began talking. You were talking about Bernstein. And it reminds us of what he said, that's a very famous quote, that our response to violence is to make our music more passionately, more committed than ever.
Yes.
Those aren't exactly the right words, but that's that's what he's talking about. And and heading back to Tanglewood, it feels like a re-energizing of that mission. And you're right, I think that for you and for the BSO, this is what we count on you for, you know. So we're so glad that you do
like
it.
A musical army in a very positive sense. You know, we do
nice
and we go to Tanglewood
yeah.
and we have the great donors, but so we build a new building in Tanglewood for inviting more people for so I think that's and it's also interesting what we see in the world, the new concert halls, new art in China, in Europe, in America. Is there are good things also happening. I think that this is as a confrontation against that we have to do more and more these good things, I think, and that's the only thing we can do. We can't do anything else, but we can do, and by that we can influence, hopefully.
Yes.
And we should sing more and more and play more and more and more and more, louder and louder, and actually that is, music has a big power. I mean, not in the sense of military power, but it's a really.
And this is, I guess, why Shostakovich got himself in trouble a lot of times, isn't it?
Yes.
Andras, thanks for taking some time to talk with
me. It was a great, great pleasure, as always. Thank you.
So if you ever wonder about the sense of purpose behind the performers you hear on stage, there you have it. Andras Nelsons clearly feels not only deeply committed to his art, but to the ways that art can have an impact in someone's life and even in the life of a community. Well, that's it for TAQ this week. You can subscribe to The Answered Question at iTunes or through your favorite podcast app, and you'll also find us on WCRV's Facebook, Twitter, and SoundCloud pages. Thank you to all of the guests on this podcast, Leif Ove Andsnes, Andras Nelsons, Marcus Thompson, Peggy Pearson, and Dimitri Murat. Thanks also to the staffs of the Boston Symphony and the Boston Chamber Music Society for making these conversations possible, and thanks to my friend and colleague, Kathy Fuller. I'm Brian McCreath. Thanks for listening.